Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavor on CGSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, also on the web at www.cgsf.ca, or you can listen to us on TELUS HD channel 7014. We have a great show for you today. From the show Seed, we have actor and comedian Adam Corson, so we'll be talking to him about that hilarious show. And also you'll be hearing from UBC Writing professor and author Nancy Lee. Her first novel is The Age, which is out now, and it took her 12 years to write, and so we'll talk to her about some of the major changes that she came about when she was writing the novel. And you're also going to hear from a great band, J.D. Sampson and Men, and we'll be having an interview with J.D. Sampson a little later on in the program. But right now, you are going to hear from her album Labor. This is the song All the Way Through.
Voices used to moan. New opens.
was J.D. Samson and Men with All the Way Through off their new album Labor, and you'll be hearing from J.D. Samson a little later on in the show. But right now, my first guest is an actor on the Vancouver shot and produced comedy Seed, about a man who discovers he has fathered children through sperm donation. I spoke with the star of that show, Adam Corson, a couple of weeks ago. I'm joined on the phone now by Adam Corson. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Dan. Thanks for having me.
So, Seed is hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
When you first heard about this project, what were your thoughts on the subject matter? Did you have any reservations?
Not at all, actually. No reservations. You know, it's interesting. When I first heard about it, you know, it came from the audition and reading the script and the sides. You know, you kind of, again, you as an actor, you approach these things, you know, more so this is a job, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I hope it's good and I hope it works out. And when I read the script, I was then pleasantly surprised to see how witty and smart the writing was, and that it wasn't just a setup to a joke, and that there was this heart that lived in the script, you know, that I hadn't seen in a really long time. And, you know, the subject matter is really just kind of the means to, you know, what is really going on here, which is, you know, a family and you know, a newfound father and, you know, responsibility, you know, as a parent to your children, and there are all these really cool themes happening. And then I was excited on top of all that because it is such a, you know, it's a relevant subject to this day and age.
Yeah.
I was just really over the moon to see the boundaries that were you know, being crossed and opened up, and yeah, it was. I've always been one to push the envelope, so it was cool to see that.
Would you describe the audition process as a relatively normal one?
No, I wouldn't. I live in LA, and my Canadian agent in Vancouver sent me the audition. They were auditioning this role in Toronto and really all over the place. And nowadays you can throw something on tape and send it in. So I was in LA. I made the tape. I sent it to my agent in Vancouver, who sent it to Toronto. And then about a month went by and found out that I was going to be reading for producers in LA in a couple of weeks. I did that. I read with Joseph Rasso, our creator. And then a couple of weeks after that, we got the call that I was flying to Toronto to test, and that process was a hellish one. It was a 2-day test. There was 4 of us the first day, and we were reading with 3 other actresses in the morning for the Rose character, and 3 other actresses in the afternoon for the Irene character. And then based on that day, 2 people were going to be sent home, and then 2 more were coming back to read with the rest of the cast, or the rest of the characters. And that was just like this round robin, full day affair. And it was intense. It was absolutely intense. I was not sleeping, not because I was nervous. I really, at that point, I was like, you either play or you don't. But for some reason, I swear, there was like a ghost in my hotel room that was not allowing me to close my eyes. And I was just, for 2 days, I couldn't sleep. It was painful, but I guess it worked out.
You mentioned that the topic of Seed is fairly relevant, and we're seeing a lot more coverage in the news media about sperm donations and sort of, you know, sperm donor fathers. When you finally booked the role, where did you go for research or inspiration, or, you know, to find out about this world?
Well, I actually have a lot of experience with sperm donation, whether that's professional or not. I mean, too gross? Did I cross the line?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. we're on the same page here.
Right. You know, as far as researchers, you know, I didn't go to a clinic or anything like that, but what I did, I started, you know, really looking at, you know, the topic itself and what was happening in the world at the time and, you know, news stories and whatnot. And what was actually fascinating to see was that, you know, it's a comedy and we take this serious subject. And we use that, you know, as an impetus for this comedy. But, you know, realizing how serious this subject is, I think opened up my eyes. You know, and again, for me, as I said before, I saw the heart in this story. But it really just kind of proved to me that this shouldn't be taken lightly. That this isn't just a show on sperm donation. That there are people out there who want to have a family, they want to have children, and they're either in a relationship that, you know, can't make that happen, or they're, you know, biologically, yeah, you know, can't make that happen, and so they go to sperm donation or egg donation, and this is their way of having a family. So understanding how serious the subject was, or and is, really allowed me to, you know, again, hold it at a level that wasn't, I just throw it away, you know.
Yeah.
I gave it the respect, I think, that it deserves.
I'm curious, you know, your thoughts about this. There's a few stories in the media now about the rights of sperm donor fathers, whether they should have the same parental rights as the mother or the non-biological father or whatever the case may be. Do you have any personal thoughts on that? Do you think that's something that the show should actively go towards, if it, you know, in a way that it doesn't already?
Whether a sperm donor father should have the same right?
Like, I'll give you an example. There's the actor Jason Patrick, for example, who had a child with his ex-girlfriend, and now she's saying that all he was a sperm donor father, and now he's trying to fight for rights. And so I guess my question is, you know, if someone is, you know, donates sperm and becomes a parent, should they get, you know, the same legal parental rights as the, you know, the physical parent, if you will?
Well, I think it's an interesting question. You know, in the case of the actor, it seems like, you know, that was a consensual relationship that, you know, it just so happened that, you know, I don't mean to make it sound, you know,
right,
you know, lightly. I don't want to take this, you know, that situation lightly, but that they had sex and there's a baby now, and whether he was there as in a relationship with her or not, and I mean that's more of, I think that's a different story than actual sperm donors,
right.
You know, most sperm donation is done anonymously, and I think it's done anonymously because, you know, it's these, for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, guys need money or they're, you know, really they want to be able to help families, and so this is their way. And if a sperm donor who was anonymous wanted, I don't think that an anonymous sperm donor would track down his kid.
Right.
I think that if a kid to track down their anonymous sperm donor, that's a tough question. Would he have a legal right? Well, no. Legally, I think that he wouldn't have a right. Because of the anonymity around it,
right,
and everything that like that, you know, people have asked me, "Would I donate sperm?" And you know, I don't think that I could donate anonymously. I think that for me, you know, if I'm donating sperm, that means that my child is out there, and I would want to have I understand, I think Harry is coming at it from a different standpoint because he did it anonymously. His kids are there, and I think for him, he was at a point in his life where, subconsciously, he wanted a family, and this was his way of fulfilling a need. For me, I would want to, if someone came up to me, whether it's a friend or whoever, and asked me to donate sperm, I would do it that way. I would do it so that, if the child would have this opportunity to know me, to know where they came from. But I wouldn't necessarily hold anyone accountable. I wouldn't necessarily need anything. This was, my way. But I think that what needs to be done, there needs to be a certain level of protection. And I think right. that perhaps that's what's lacking, is that however you're donating, anonymously, I think that there is protection there. If it's not anonymously, I think it has to work out like any kind of marriage contract, where things are stated, this is how things are going to be when the child is born, and so that everything's out on the table. There's another, around the time we were shooting the first season, there was this article that came out about this sperm donor who is being taken to court because he donated sperm, and there was some, I don't know if you heard about this, the child, I think, had some health issues, and I don't think that the parents were going to him for money and were suing him for money, but the court was holding him responsible because he was technically the father, and they were saying that he had a legal obligation to help pay for the health care. And see, so that's where it gets tricky.
Yeah.
As he was out of the kindness of his heart, he was trying to help out these people, and now he's liable. So I just don't think that there are, in those cases, people just have to make sure to protect themselves.
Yeah.
To make sure that everyone is on the same page.
Speaking of protection, I know, there's a couple of young kids in the cast, Abby and William.
Yeah.
How do you... how would you say you shield them, if at all, from some of the more maybe risque moments of the show?
In real life, how do I shield them from that?
Yeah. If at all.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't know if I actually do shield them from, they have their parents on set, which is great, and their parents are unbelievable, and they're very supportive. So I think a lot of, once they get to the set, I think questions have already been asked and answered. Although a really cool, funny story was in the first season, I don't think Will knew, he didn't really know about sperm donation.
Right.
And so he was asking me, how does this work? And so there is this really, again, just adorable moment where I was talking to him, and his younger brother, who's 7, was on set at the time, and I think we actually recorded it. And it's me telling Will, it was like, life imitates art moment, telling Will and his brother about sperm donation and how it works and essentially where babies come from. It was incredible, and his mom was there, and it was I kind of gave her a check-in look before I started talking to make sure it was okay. But we have this really cool feel on set. It's La Familia, it's family, and we're so supportive of each other, and there's this really cool level of respect that everybody has for each other. Which really, it's such a cool environment to create in, and we're always pulling pranks and trying to make people laugh, and their takes and whatnot. So everyone also knows that they're kids on set, so we're pretty. Will has this swear jar.
Yes, I've heard of such things.
Swear money goes in, and then they donate it, so that's nice.
Best prank you've pulled on the set.
Okay. Best prank. It was actually pulled on me, I think.
Oh.
Would that be the best prank? Hold on, can you give me a second? I'm just going to think about this because I got to go through them.
Yeah.
Okay, this really cool thing was, it was pulled on me, where every time I would come back to my trailer, there'd be rocks in my shoes. Like, people would just put these rocks in my shoes, and I had no clue who was doing it. The last day, I found out it was Amanda who was doing that. She was putting rocks in my shoes. So, and Amanda was notorious, actually, for losing her phone. So, this is really, like, the worst. This isn't even good. You had to be there. Okay, I'll tell you this other one. Okay, scratch that one. We can delete that one.
Okay.
So, at lunch, we get per diem at lunch.
Right.
So, Carrie got her per diem, and she was talking to someone, and I very stealthily took her per diem, and, like, nothing had happened, walked away, and went to my trailer, where there were rocks in my shoes. But got to my trailer and had her per diem, and I found out later that she was rifling through the trash because she thought she had thrown out her per diem, which is like a good, I don't know, like $500.
Right, right.
And I had it in my trailer, and she was just, like, covered in garbage because she couldn't find her per diem.
Oh, that's a classic.
So I was pretty proud of that one. Never got me back, though. Never got me back.
And I got to ask you about working with Mark Farrell. He's such a legend in Canadian comedy.
Yes. Sorry, who? Mark?
Mark Farrell.
Yeah, I'm joking. Mark Farrell, he really lives up to his reputation. He is a genius. And, he comes at the job with such creativity and such openness, and you do really feel the sense of collaboration and support when he's on set. When he's behind the monitors, you're in this, like, really safe place. You trust his eye, and he's hilarious. I mean, he's just, again, like I said, he lives up to his reputation. There's a reason why he's known as a comedy genius, because he is.
And finally, what's this about you being named to Hello Canada's 50 Most Beautiful People?
It's true. It's true. That happened.
How do you feel about an honor like that?
I feel like it was my time. It's weird, man. It's very weird. I keep saying, I wake up every morning, I look myself in the mirror, and I say, you're beautiful. You're beautiful. I'm just trying to go for a second year in a row.
Yeah.
Because that would be a letdown. Like, all of a sudden, you're not beautiful anymore.
Right.
No, it's cool. It was a weird moment, but I appreciate it.
Well, the show is Seed, and it airs Thursday nights on City TV. Adam Corson, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a blast.
Cheers. Once again, that was Adam Corson from Seed, which airs on City on Thursdays at 9 p.m. And it also just got picked up in the U.S. by CW. Okay, we're going to hear another song from J.D. Samson and Men. This is Semenya. was J.D. Sampson and Men with Semenya off their album Labor. I had the chance to speak with creator and frontwoman J.D. Sampson about a week and a half ago. I'm joined on the phone now by J.D. Sampson of J.D. Sampson and Men. Hello, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thank you for having me.
So the new album is Labor. Can you talk a little bit about how this project got its start and ultimately came to be?
Sure. The band Men started in 2007 as kind of like a melding of two different projects. One was Men, which was previously a DJ and original music project with myself and Johanna Fateman, and the other was a project called Pursuit, which was myself and Ginger Brooks Takahashi and Mike Bloniel and Emily Royston. And so we kind of decided to merge the two projects and make a record, which was the first record called Talk About Bodies, and that came out in 2011. And since then, we've had different people in and out of the project, and the last record was made with the core members, myself and Michael O'Neill, and then with some producers that we worked with on different tracks.
You've talked about this project as showing the radical potential of dance music. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think in my previous project, Latigra, we focused a lot on trying to integrate like kind of like intellectual conversation and conceptual art and performance art into dance music, and we felt like it was kind of the perfect venue to express, you know, kind of like identity politics and body politics, because you can feel so safe when you're dancing, and it's such a vulnerable place to be in, and it kind of feels that much better when you feel like you're doing it intelligently and doing it with a group of people that respect you and that you feel safe around. So it was kind of a perfect thing for our community.
When you first set out to be a musician, be an artist, did you know that you were going to be this political?
I think that's all I knew, actually. And you know, my art has always been political and also somehow like more conceptual, I guess. And so I think that those are two things that I think my art will always have, whether I'm making visual art or I'm making films or making music. You know, I think that it's always important for me to express myself politically and also just like think about different aspects of making art other than just expressing myself, you know?
Yeah. Do you find that no matter what it is, you know, art in some way is always political because it's a reflection of us?
I think so, for sure. I mean, people ask me that all the time, like, you know, is All the Way Through, which is a love song on the record, political to you? And it is very much to me, because I think that, like, the idea of the language that comes out of any particular body and any particular identity makes it political inherently. And I think that that's something that I talk about a lot in interviews, actually, is that, you know, anything I make is going to have this, like, air of politics, and whether that's through gender expression or other identity politics, like, that it just feels like that's what will always be.
I know that one of the issues that your band speaks about is trans awareness. And, in the last year or two, we've seen a lot more of trans people come forward, and this issue really receiving a lot more press than it has in the past. How far do you think we've come in terms of talking about trans issues?
Well, I think, there has been a revolution in the past 10 years that's been really incredible. I think there's way more openness to gender expression in general, and people are somehow drifting away from like the binary structure of what is masculine and feminine, and I think there's more openness to the fluidity of gender, which I love. But I think there's a lot of work to be done, and I can see that mostly when I'm on tour and I'm traveling through towns and going to rest stops and gas stations and stuff, and I feel like there's a huge difference between living in an urban environment that has like a lot of LGBT resources and a lot of LGBT conversations, really, and culturally, you know, significant LGBT kind of organizations and things. So I think there is a lot of work to be done, but I'm always a fan of anything that creates visibility, and that's something I'm pretty sure of. I remember when people were saying the same thing about the L word, like they were like, seems like lesbian culture is coming into the forefront of media, but it's so transparent and mainstream, and it's like, at the same time, I want to think of it as a movement of visibility, and any visibility is really going to help people to realize that we're everywhere, you know? So I definitely think that I'm excited about all of the, you know, motions towards trans people in TV and music and films and everything. So it's a good moment for sure, but there's always more work to be done.
The other issue I wanted to ask you about is how you became involved with the Free Pussy Riot movement and your single Let Them Out or Let Me In.
I was in Europe actually doing a DJ tour, and I had read a bunch of articles in The Guardian about Pussy Riot, and like subsequently went on to the New York Times website to try and see if they were writing anything, and I didn't see anything, and I thought it was really interesting that Europe was covering the kind of like story so well and so like in depth, and that in the U.S. I didn't see the same kind of coverage. So when I got back to the States, I reached out to a couple of people that were doing some organizing and decided that I wanted to become a part of it. And originally my intention was kind of to build a festival in Moscow that was surrounding the release and or just like the support of Pussy Riot with a bunch of artists from the States. But a lot of the promoters in Moscow were too worried about people coming in and just the protest that might cause. So we decided to do something in the States, and then I held a reading at the Ace Hotel in New York that was kind of like a bunch of famous feminists in New York read their lyrics and writings from prison, and it was really well attended, and there was a lot of press, and I think it helped a lot to spread the word and just build more visibility around the issue. And I guess at the same time we were writing the rest, I was thinking that I needed some lyrics for this track, and it was about something totally different, and I just erased it all and rewrote it as a Pussy Riot tribute.
When you write, do you find that you're always like, do you have a beat set out first and then try to add lyrics over top, or do you have lyrics and then try to set a beat to them?
Most of the time I like start with some sort of a sample or beat or idea, and then like write lyrics. Some songs where I've had like an idea or a concept that I wanted to work with, but that I wasn't sure which song it would go for, you know?
Yeah.
And, or like an idea of like, I want to write a song about this, and I want the song to be like really driving and a fast tempo and whatever, and then we'll kind of like create it around that idea. But I don't know, every song I think was really different. But for the most part, there's music before there's vocal with this project.
And finally, would you say you have a favorite song off of Labor?
It's so funny. It changes a lot. Like, I think, you know, at first, I think my favorite song was All the Way Through. I think it went through so many different phases and kind of, like, came out on top, and I felt really excited out of what, you know, it was. But then after playing the songs live and everything, I think they all start to have a new meaning, and I really like the song She, that one feels really cool, and I don't know. I guess I like playing Semenya a lot. That one's fun because it's so fast. But, yeah, that's what I would say.
Well, J.D. Sampson and Men, the album is a labor. You should check it out. J.D. Sampson, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, we're playing, too. Did you know that?
Yeah, you're coming to Vancouver tomorrow, March the 11th, at the Cobalt.
Yeah, cool.
Alrighty, take care. Hope to see you there.
Okay, bye.
Cheers. And once again, that was J.D. Sampson of the band J.D. Sampson and Men, and their album is Labor. My final guest is Associate Professor of Creative Writing at UBC. She's the author of the previous collection of stories called Dead Girls. Her debut novel, which she says took her 12 years to write, is The Age. She is Nancy Lee, and I spoke with her about her novel and about her approach to writing over the weekend. I am joined now on the phone by author Nancy Lee. Hello, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So your debut novel is The Age.
That's right.
And you... Now, I know you had authored a story collection in the past. When you set out to write this, did you know that it was going to be a longer work of fiction right away?
Oh, absolutely. From the moment I sort of conceived of the story, I knew it would be a novel. Structurally, it sort of demanded a longer form. And so with short stories, you know, you can kind of be inspired by a moment, feeling, an image, whereas this I knew was going to be a longer narrative, and it involved sort of two narratives running at the same time, so I knew it was going to be a novel.
So what is your process like then, you know, writing a novel from sort of genesis of the idea to character development and backstory to actually physically typing it out?
Oh my goodness. Well, I suppose one thing I should say first is it took me 12 years to write this novel, so whatever sort of process I had imagined at the beginning certainly got turned on its head as I sort of worked on it year after year. I had a fairly clear idea at the beginning about the characters and sort of how the narrative was going to come together, but what I found was that after writing each draft, and I would say I probably wrote in over the 12 years, six distinct drafts, meaning six drafts that bore almost no resemblance to each other. And each one was a process of kind of excavating the story. I would end up throwing out hundreds of pages and trying to figure out, you know, what is, trying to get to the heart of the story, the heart of the characters. And about halfway through, about the six-year mark, that was when I realized that the book that I had been writing, which involved a teenage boy as a protagonist, was in fact the story of a teenage girl, and that turned everything on its head. So for me, the process was really about digging deeper into the themes, into the ideas, into the characters, until I found sort of what I was trying to work towards.
How different is life from a teenage girl's perspective rather than a teenage boy's?
Oh, it's entirely different. changing the gender of the main character meant having to change every other character in the book. It also meant having to change really the focus of all the relationships and the focus of the story itself. But one thing that happened was the moment, and it took me a long time to accept the idea of changing the gender. It's not like I decided one day, well, I'm just going to try this. I was reading an excerpt, a scene from the novel at my writing group, and somebody made the comment, you know, every time you read from your novel, I can't help but feel like your main character wants to be a girl or is a girl. And I thought, well, that's a stupid thing to say. That's ridiculous. And it took about 8 months for me to really wrap my head around, you know, whether or not it could even work. And then once I began to approach the character as a teenage girl, it was almost as if everything started to fit together, like I had found a sort of a key to a puzzle and everything started to click into place. But it meant reimagining almost every aspect of the book.
Did you find that once you would change Jerry to a female, you were able to incorporate some of your own experiences of being a girl that age?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. I write a lot about teenage characters, so I feel like I have a kind of access either through my own experience or through just watching teenagers in the world or trying to go back in my imagination to what it was like to be a teenager. Was it easier to write as a teenage girl? I'm not sure. I definitely think some of the anxieties were easier to access, that perhaps I don't necessarily have my finger on the pulse of the anxieties that teenage boys are feeling. So I would say that part I was able to kind of go back to my own experience and draw from that for sure.
What is it about that age that you enjoy writing about so much?
Well, I think part of it is there's a kind of process of discovery of the outside world, making sense of the outside world, and also feeling like you want to do something about the world, which I kind of associate with being a teenager. So, kind of watching the world as it is and being maybe disgusted or upset or angry about the way things are. I don't know, I find that kind of as you get older, and I lump myself into this category, as you get older, you become more complacent, you become more accepting of the way things are, which I think is kind of like a probably level of spiritual acceptance. But the thing that I love about thinking back to my own teenage years and also looking at teenagers these days is just how passionate they get about things and how upset they get about things. And I think it's a time when you feel like you're trying to make sense of how to exert some personal control over the world, which I think dramatically in terms of writing fiction is a very interesting sort of lens to look through.
That notion of discovering the world, do you think that can relate to the writer in a lot of ways? A lot of artists use art to make new discoveries about themselves and the world around them.
Absolutely. And I think that, most of my friends who are writers, and, I share this belief that we write in order to make sense of things that we can't understand. When you look at problems that are going on, whether it's on a kind of interpersonal human level or on a more societal or global level, writing is one of the ways that you try to answer the questions that seem unanswerable. So one of the questions for me in this book was, looking back to my own feelings of anxiety around the nuclear age when I was, 13, 14 years old. For me, that was kind of a metaphor for how do we even continue to live knowing that one day we're going to die? How do we choose to continue moving forward and choosing to be active and do things in our lives? Why don't we just kind of lay down on the couch and give up? So that was kind of the metaphor that I was working with, and so I think like Jerry's experience feeling frustrated with the outside world, feeling powerless, is the way that a lot of people feel at different points in their lives.
It says here that
go ahead.
I was just saying, it says here that the age is a journey through adolescent recklessness and a portrait of a generation shaped by nuclear anxiety. And it seems that the generation of young people today, sort of mid-teens to mid-20s, there are a lot of worries for them, whether it's, nuclear, environmental destruction. How would you sort of relate what Jerry is going through to a lot of the issues that we're seeing in today's society that affect young people?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, when I think back to when I was, a young person, and I can remember being in a grade 8 social class and the teacher asking, how many of you think you're going to live past the age of 25? And only half of the class put up their hand, and I wasn't one of them. Because so many of us were living with this context of war, which involved kind of rising tensions between superpower nations and somebody pressing a button and basically ending the world. I mean, you got told on a regular basis on the news that we had enough of a nuclear arsenal to kill, destroy the entire world. I can't remember how many times over, 640 times over or something insane like that. And I see the same sort of anxiety today in young people when they're looking at environmental issues. I can remember when I was young watching the movies The Day After and Threads, which were all about nuclear annihilation. And I can imagine that when young people watch the documentary Inconvenient Truth, they felt exactly the same way, that how could previous generations let things get to this point? And how can we not be doing absolutely everything in our power, every moment, every waking moment, to stop this from happening? And I can't imagine, you know, how frustrating it must be for young people to feel like they've kind of inherited this situation, are going to be stuck with it, the way that I felt about the nuclear crisis, which was, how did previous generations mess it up so bad that there probably won't even be a world left for my generation to live in?
Do you find that there's a lot of yourself in Jerry?
Well, that's a tricky question. I'm not the sort of writer who does a lot of autobiographical writing, but you can't help but, things sort of slip in whether you want them to or not. So I'm trying to think of what there is of me. I mean, I would say that kind of recklessness was probably part of my own childhood as well, but definitely not to the extent that Jerry is reckless. That sort of wanting to be part of something was definitely part of my youth, but at the same time, I think that Jerry is being sort of put upon by very specific forces that weren't part of my life. So I was very lucky to have a fairly secure home environment, and I don't think I would have ever been, I don't know if brave is the right word, but I would have never been brave enough to get involved with the group that's doing what the group that Jerry's involved is doing. I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah. Now, I know you also teach creative writing. So how do you teach somebody how to write?
Well, we don't really teach someone how to write per se, but what we try to do is create a supportive environment, provide a lot of craft-based learning, so kind of learning about forms and how to do certain things that you want to do in your writing, and just offer a venue for students to really explore what they're interested in exploring. In our program at UBC, we teach all levels from, undergrads who are probably majoring in an entirely different faculty, all the way up to grad students who are already kind of writing at a professional level and looking towards publication. And the idea really is to sort of foster the students' creative experience and give as many tools as we can to our students so that they can become better craftspeople and know about their form and understand it on a deep level. So it's not just, oh, I have these ideas and I want to express my creativity. It's, I understand how a story works, I understand the components of the story, and I can execute a successful story from beginning to end.
And I wanted to ask you about your time as a panelist on Canada Reads.
Oh, yes.
talk about... You're with another group of celebrities defending other writers. Just talk about being in that sort of environment.
I missed that last part. Was it just talk about being on the panel?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was on. I can't remember if it was the first Canada Reads or the second Canada Reads. It was one of the very early ones, and I was quite naive about it. I think it was the second one. I think I was quite naive about it because I had imagined that what it would be a group of people who loved books getting together and basically arguing on behalf of the book that they were defending. So I was defending Yann Martel's novel, The Life of Pi, which I absolutely adore and think is an incredibly ambitious, amazing piece of literature. And what I was not prepared for was, from the moment we got into the studio, these perfectly nice people who were my co-panelists turned into these cutthroat, sort of attacking entities, and it became a process of kind of tearing the books down one by one, which I've always maintained is a huge problem with Canada Reads. As far as I'm concerned, Canada doesn't read enough, and so by the sort of process of whittling it down to one book that everyone should read is kind of a bit ridiculous, especially when you're starting out with five books that are already amazing and that everyone should be reading anyway. So it was a bit of a harrowing experience, and the next year I kind of stayed involved and was sort of on the committee that helped try to select the books that would be talked about. But the same thing, you know, continued to happen, which was the discussion was almost like a survivor-like, had a survivor-like tone to it, where, you know, people getting, books were getting voted off. And so, I mean, I would be really encouraged if CBC decided to try something where people were encouraged to read more than just one book. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah. Well, the book is The Age by Nancy Lee, which is out now, and everyone should go and pick it up and read it, and read as many other books as you can as well. Nancy Lee, thanks so much for your time today, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too.
All right. And that was Nancy Lee, and once again, her book is The Age, and it's out now, and I spoke to her from Vancouver last weekend. Well, that about does it for this week. I'd like to thank Nancy Lee. I'd like to thank Adam Corson of Seed, and of course, J.D. Sampson and Men. Their album is Labor. You should check it out. It's awesome. We're going to take you out with their song next. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.